he could be a part of made him that tiny bit harder to kill. No one thing he did made a difference. All of it together might decide between mercy or a bullet in the back of his skull somewhere not too far down the line. So Holden chuckled like the guard was a friend and ambled out into the gardens. There were patterns in the life of the state building. Everyone had routines, whether they knew it or not. Here at the heart of the empire, with thousands of people making their way into and out of and through the buildings at the source of authority and power, he could have spent lifetimes tracking them all. It was like sitting and watching a termite hive until each insect stopped being itself and turned into an organ in a much larger, older consciousness. If he lived as long as Duarte intended to, he still wouldn't understand all the subtleties of it. For his present purposes, the smaller patterns were enough. Things like Cortázar enjoyed winning at chess, and the guard lieutenant liked sugar in her coffee, and Duarte's daughter went out into the gardens in the late morning, especially when she was upset. Not that she always did. Some days Holden put himself in what he hoped would be her path, and wound up spending hours reading old adventure novels or watching censor-approved entertainment feeds. Not news. He had access to the state propaganda feeds, but he couldn't bring himself to watch them. Either they'd make him angry, and he couldn't afford to be angry, or through simple repetition, they'd start to seem true. He couldn't afford that either. Today he picked a little pagoda set by an artificial stream. The plants there were local varieties. The leaf-like structures were darker than the plants he'd known growing up. Blue-black with whatever chlorophyll analog Laconia's evolutionary history had come up with. Still wide, to catch the energy of the sun. Still tall, to get above everything they were competing with. Similar pressures yielded similar solutions, just the way flight had evolved 5 different times on Earth. Good moves in design space. That's what Elvi Okoye had called it. He took out his handheld, and for almost 2 hours let himself sink into an old murder mystery set on an ice hauler in the belt before the gates opened, and written by someone who had clearly never been on an ice hauler in their life. The first sign that he wasn't alone was the barking. He put down his reading just as the old Labrador came galloping around the hedge, grinning the way only dogs could. Holden took the sausage out of his pocket and let the dog eat it from his palm while he scratched the old girl's ears. There was no better way to seem trustworthy than to be liked by a dog, and there was no better way to convince a dog to like you than bribery. "Who's a good dog?" he said. The dog huffed once just as the girl came around. Teresa, the heir apparent, princess of the empire. She was 14, and in the phase of adolescence where every emotion spilled down her face. He barely had to glance at her to know that something had wrecked her. "Hey," he said, the way he always did. Every time the same, so that the pattern of it became familiar. So that he became familiar. Because things that are familiar aren't a threat. Normally, she answered with, "Hello," but today she broke the pattern. She didn't say anything at all, just looked at her dog and avoided Holden's gaze. Her eyes were bloodshot, with dark smudges under them. Her skin was paler than usual. Whatever was going on, it was personal to her. That narrowed the options down. "You know what's weird?" he said. "I saw Dr. Cortázar at breakfast, and he was in a big rush. Normally he'll stop, chew the fat for a little while. Today he skinned right out of there. Didn't even bother to whip my ass on the chessboard." "He's busy right now," Teresa said. Her voice was as ruined as she was. "He has a patient, Dr. Okoye, the one from the science directorate. Her husband, too. She got hurt, and she's here at the state building so she and father can talk. She isn't hurt badly. She'll be fine, but Dr. Cortázar is helping to take care of her. At the end of the speech, she nodded like she was reviewing what she'd said and approved of it. It was a small gesture, the kind that would lose her a lot of money if she ever started playing cards. "I'm sorry to hear that," Holden said. "I hope she gets better." He didn't ask what had happened. He didn't dig for information. He should have left it at that. From a tactical point of view, anything more was a mistake. "Hey," he said, "I may not be the guy you want to hear this from, but whatever it is, it's going to be okay." The girl's eyes went wide, and then they went hard. It didn't take a second. "I don't know what you're talking about," she said, then turned and stalked away, slapping her palm against her leg to call the dog. The dog looked from her to Holden, regret in the dark brown eyes. The hope of more sausage weighed against the distress of her person. "Go," Holden said, nodding at Teresa's retreating back. The dog barked once, a friendly sound, and galloped away again. Holden tried to go back to his book, but his attention kept wandering. He waited for almost an hour, then put the handheld away and walked. A cool breeze was starting up. He thought about going back to his cell and getting a jacket, but decided not to. Something about being a little uncomfortable was right for the day. Instead, he made his way to the mausoleums. Garlands of flowers rested in the corner where the stone met the ground, red and white and a lavish purple. Some were native Laconian plants, some were out of a hydroponics tank. They'd be replaced until the order came to stop replacing them. If the people in authority forgot, there might be fresh flowers at Avasarala's grave forever. The woman herself looked down at him from where she was etched in stone. It was probably just his imagination, but she seemed amused, like now that she was dead and not actually responsible for fixing any of the vast and secret shit show that was human history, she finally got the joke. He looked up at her, remembering her voice, the way she'd moved, her eyes bright and intelligent, and pitiless as a crow's. "What is going on here?" he asked softly. "What am I looking at?" It didn't matter if they heard that. Without the context of his thoughts, it wouldn't mean anything. He was seeing Teresa, devastated. The state building vibrating with banked anxiety. Cortázar, entitled, narcissistic, proto-molecule-obsessed Cortázar, quietly gleeful. Another bout of strange consciousness and lost time. This one, at least in Laconia's system, and maybe beyond. Elvi Okoye's return being used as a cover story for Cortázar's presence at the state building, because he needed to be there, was happy to be there, and someone wanted to hide the real reasons why. Put like that, something had happened to Duarte. If it was true, Cortázar's hands were freer, which meant his plans to vivisect and kill Duarte's daughter would probably kick into high gear. And also Elvi was back from her missions in the other system, so Holden's plans could move forward too. It was a race now, and he had a strong suspicion that he was behind. That was too bad. He had hoped to have more time.
"Don't be a whiny little cunt,"
Avasarala said in his imagination.
"Hope in one hand and shit in the other.
See which one fills up first. Get to work." First he chuckled, and then he sighed.
"Fair point," he said to the dead woman. This time she didn't answer.
He turned and walked back toward the buildings as the first genuinely cold rush of air came and stirred the ground cover that wasn't quite grass. There would be a storm by nightfall. He was sure of it. Maybe snow. Snow was the same everywhere. He had to find his next step. Maybe Elvi. Maybe her husband, Faez. He'd always liked Faez. Maybe Teresa. Maybe it was time to go to Duarte, if it wasn't already too late. If only there had been more time. This was the problem with thousand-year Reichs. They came and they went, like fireflies. Chapter 25. Naomi. Naomi had lived long enough to see history change more than once now. In the reality where she'd been born, Earth and Mars had maintained an alliance built to keep their boot permanently on the neck of belters like her. The idea of alien life had been something for scientific speculations and thrillers on entertainment feeds. Some changes had been so slow it was almost possible to miss that they were happening. The change of belter identity from underclass to the de facto governing party at the height of the transport union's power had spanned decades. The rebuilding of Ganymede after its collapse also. The others had been sudden, or it seemed that way. When Eros moved, when the gates opened, when the rocks fell on Earth, when Laconia came back. The sudden changes, as different as they were, all followed the same pattern. After it happened, whatever it was, humanity went into a kind of shock. Not just her and the people around her, but the whole vast and varied tribe of people. For a moment, it was as if they were all still primates on the fields of Africa, going silent at a lion's roar. All the rules they'd lived by were suddenly open to question. The inner planets have always been my enemy. But are they still? The far reaches of the solar system are as distant as humanity will ever be, but can we go farther? Earth will endure, won't it? Naomi didn't like the feeling, but she recognized it. And more than that, she saw the power in it. Moments like these were opportunities. They could bring new alliances, new empathy, a new and broader sense of being together in a single human tribe, or they could be the poison that ran through human minds for decades to come and welcomed ancient wars onto new and bloody battlefields. Oberon held its breath and waited to see if the predators were coming for it. She saw it on the in-system news feeds that were the only news feeds now. It was in the wideness of the Laconian governor's eyes, and, Naomi had to admit, it was in her own heart, too. The typhoon was the absolute symbol of Laconian dominance. After the Tempest's inexorable conquest of Sol System, Laconian rule was a given. It wasn't just that Laconia had found a way to defend the ring space against simultaneous attacks from any or all gates, though that was part of it. It was also the clear knowledge that by being in the slow zone, the typhoon was already halfway to anyone's home. That once it started coming, nothing could stop it but the whim of the Empire. And now, it was gone. Medina Station had been a feature of the ring space from the start. It had been one of the first ships through the Sol Ring, and taken up its place even before the other gates had opened. Medina had been the farthest trading post of the new land rush, and then the traffic cop at the center of the colony worlds. Its history as a religious generation ship, and then as a battleship for the OPA, had made it as rich and complicated as the people who lived on it. It was a permanent fact of how humanity moved through the rings, as constant and permanent as the rings themselves. It was gone too. If it had been just one or the other, maybe it would have been simpler. But having the hammer that had threatened every head in the Empire and the longest-standing human presence at the gates, both wiped away at once, pulled Naomi's heart in two directions. She was rejoicing and mourning at the same time, and also feeling the deep unease that came from the reminder that being familiar wasn't the same as being understood.
"How do you take your eggs?"
Hava asked. Naomi, sitting at the breakfast bar, rubbed the sleep from her eyes.
"Usually reconstituted, and from a nozzle.
So, scrambled? That would be great." Hava's rooms were in a fashionable part of the station, assuming there was an unfashionable part. Oberon hadn't existed long enough to have history built in its bones yet. Nothing there had been reappropriated or reused or reimagined yet. The hard industrial white of Hava's kitchen was exactly as the designer had imagined it. The ferns in the hydroponic vases that showed the white of their roots and the green of their fronds were placed exactly where they would photograph best. The windows looking out over the common space 3 levels below, as if it were a city apartment on Earth, except cleaner, had the intended effect. In a generation or four, it would develop its own style and character. But it hadn't yet. Or maybe Naomi just needed to get some coffee and work out. That was possible, too.
"Did you sleep well?"
Hava asked over the sizzle and pop of eggs on their hot pan.
"I don't usually have visitors. You're the first one to be in the guest room for more than a night."
"It's lovely," Naomi said.
"Is there any news?"
Hava put a white ceramic coffee cup on the bar next to Naomi's elbow, and then a small glass French press already filled with black coffee beside it. "The political officer at the transfer station is saying all traffic out of the gate is prohibited until we've had instructions from Laconia, which is tricky because the repeaters are still down. There's a freighter that was on its way out when the shit hit the fan, and the transport union is saying that if it doesn't get its cargo to Far Home system, there'll be a lot of starving people a year from now." Naomi poured the coffee into the cup. Black welled up in the overwhelming white, steam rising up from it. The smell was lighter than she was used to. She wondered if Jim would have liked it.
"Any word from the governor?"
"Radio silence," Hava said. "There are stories that the governor's been taking payoffs for a long time. His loyalties aren't perfectly clear."
"That's weirdly refreshing," Naomi said.
The coffee tasted better than it smelled. Another layer of sleep that she hadn't recognized slipped away. The smell of the egg started to seem very interesting. Hava saw it and smiled.
"Hungry?"
"I think I am," Naomi said. "The local underground, how does it look? What kind of resources does it have?" Hava shrugged.
"I don't entirely know. Saba keeps us compartmentalized. I'm not even sure how much he knows, except that he knows who to ask if something's possible."
She realized the error in what she'd said, and her lips pressed thin.
"New, I mean. I can't quite believe he's..."
"I know," Naomi said. "Without coordination, we're not really an underground anymore. We're 1,300 different undergrounds that can't talk to each other." Communication, she thought as she sipped her coffee, was always a problem. Hava swirled the pan of eggs and decanted the fluffy yellow clouds onto a white plate. "On the upside, there are 1,300 different Laconias now. Less than that, really. A lot of the smaller colonies don't have governors on site yet. They're essentially free. And in danger of collapsing without support.
I'm not sure dying free is as attractive when it stops being rhetorical."
"Truth," Hava said. The eggs tasted strange, thicker and more substantial than the approximation that the Rossi had put out, and with a different aftertaste that Naomi couldn't decide at first whether she liked or not. Having food in her stomach felt wonderful, though, and it went well with the coffee. Hava hadn't brought up the subject of Naomi's future. They both knew that there were too many unknowns now for any plan to mean much. Even if there was a ship that could take in the shell game, there was no Saba to send her information, to analyze or consider her recommendations. Naomi's role in the underground's ability to survive, everything was radically uncertain. They papered over the gaps with hospitality and kindness. Naomi was Chava's guest, slept in her spare room, ate her food and drank her coffee as if they were sisters. It was strange to think that people lived like this. Not just citizens, either. People in the underground had nice apartments and windows with carefully sculpted views, fresh fruit and coffee. It was so exaggeratedly normal that it felt like the bait in a trap. Would Chava be able to walk away from it all the way Naomi had left the Rossi and Alex and Bobby? Or would the comfort keep her here too long if something went wrong? If something had already gone wrong? Problem? Chava asked, and Naomi realized she'd been scowling. I was thinking about... She reached for something less rude than my instinctive disapproval of your lifestyle. Traffic control in the ring space. If that freighter does make the transit, it'll be going through blind. They all will be. Now that she was saying it out loud, it actually did worry her. And there's going to be pressure. All of those colonies that aren't quite self-sustaining yet, they may wait for a while. Hold back, but sooner or later the risk of making the transit is going to be better than the certainty of having their colony fail. That's true, Chava said as she cracked another egg into the pan. But I can't see rebuilding in the ring space either. Not before we know what happened, and whether there's a way to keep it from happening again, can you? I mean, maybe Laconia will send another one of its system killer ships through and park it there again, but only if they're up for the risk of losing it. It does start looking like hazard pay, Naomi said, trying levity. It didn't feel right, though. Not yet. Once could mean anything, Chava said as the new egg started to bubble and pulse from the heat. Maybe it was just the one time. Or maybe it's every 1,000 years, or every third Thursday from now on. We don't even know what triggered it this time. By the time we have enough points to make a good scatter plot, it's a lot of dead ships. If there's even a way to know when a ship went Dutchman. There's no one watching, so who'd be keeping track? The whole communications grid is down at this point. If someone did know, they'd have to build some way to tell us. No one's in charge. Do you want some more coffee? No, thank you, Naomi said, her mind already racing along somewhere new. She and Chava weren't the only ones having this conversation. Thousands of other people in Oberon were thinking about these same things in restaurants and bars, and on ships traveling through the vast emptiness between this sun and gate. It was how the shock started to wear off, how the moment after the moment created itself. And it wasn't only Oberon, either. Every system with a ring gate was looking at the same questions, fearing the same possible futures. Every system, including Laconia. The thought landed with a weight. Her grief at the loss of Saba and Medina, and her unexpected hope in seeing the typhoon destroyed. The dread of the mysterious enemy and its escalating body count. They all led to the same conclusion. It was like a nightmare where you spent the whole night running from something and ended up in its lap all the same. No one's in charge. Sorry? Chava said as she slid her own egg with its golden yolk onto a plate. Did you say something? We're going to need to break some protocols, Naomi said. And I'll need access to a machine shop. You wouldn't know how I could get my hands on some torpedoes, do you? I don't need warheads, just the drives and the frames. Long-range designs, if we can find them. I can look, Chava said. How many do you need? Ideally, about 1,300 or 1,400. Chava laughed, saw Naomi's expression, and sobered. And, Naomi said, if the offer is still open, I might take the coffee after all. The yard that Chava found would have been small back in Sol System. There were thousands like it scattered through the belt. improvised shipyards that catered to rockhoppers and independents who couldn't afford docking fees at Callisto or Ceres or any of the other centers. Apart from the fact that this one didn't have anything manufactured over 15 years ago, it could have been anywhere. The man who ran it was called Zepp, and he had a faded, split-circle tattoo on his neck. He spoke English, Mandarin, Portuguese, and a dialect of Belter Creole that put his background in the Martian Trojans. He gave her the tour of the yard. It was a high, pale bubble of ceramic and steel with harsh white work lights overhead, and a misting of oil every morning to trap the lunar fines. Everything there was a little sticky to the touch and stank of gunpowder. It was the first place in Oberon's system she felt even slightly at home. Even with the oil, the fines, tiny bits of stone smaller than dust that erosion had never smoothed, were dangerous enough that she wore a mask and eye protection. She went through the rows of decommissioned ships that had been repossessed or damaged by misadventure or malice, to the point that it made more sense to sell them as scrap. They were mostly orbital shuttles and semi-automated prospectors. The shuttles were no use to her, but some of the prospectors had probes. They didn't have the range or speed of real torpedoes, but she could start with them. Over the course of a long, sweat-soaked morning, she'd assembled half a dozen that seemed worth closer examination. The idea wasn't that different from the bottles she'd used before. It was only the scale that was different. And the stakes. She could load transmitters and explosives into the probes and then send them out through the different gates. No one would be exposed to danger by coming through the newly haunted slow zone, and the messages would be untraceable. Anyone listening, as she had been, would hear them just like the ones she'd dropped off before. She needed to work on the exact wording. It would be the first voice from the underground since Medina. Getting it right mattered. Getting it done quickly mattered more. There had been a moment in the neo-noir films that Alex always watched that happened so often it became a cliché. She had to have seen it a dozen times over the years, and she hadn't been paying much attention. A firefight would start with operatic choreography and impossibly high-capacity magazines. The hero and the villain would play through the scenario with whatever peculiar flourishes the director had invented to make this one different from all the ones before. Then, at the climactic ending, the two enemies faced each other, and both would run out of ammunition. The resolution of all the heroic violence came down to which of them could reload faster. That was where the underground and the Empire stood. They were both disrupted. Whichever of them was able to organize again first would survive. Laconia still had the firepower. It still had the technological edge. But if the underground could rebuild a communication grid faster, she could change the story of their inevitability. Laconia's advantages wouldn't be enough. Speed mattered. If Saba were still alive, if Medina had survived, it would have been time for him to stand up, announce himself, and become the public face of the opposition, to forge the 1,300 different undergrounds that were out there now in the cut-off systems back into one thing, and exploit the confusion of the enemy before Duarte could find his feet. Take the crisis and make it a turning point, even if it meant more pressure on Drummer and the Union. Naomi would have told him it had to be done. She'd have been right. Her hand terminal chimed. She pulled off her goggles and air filter and accepted the connection. There was only one person it could be. Chava was in her office, her hair perfectly in place, her blouse unsmeared, and her demeanor as polite and professional as if she did work like this every day. "I have the secure connection you asked for," she said. "The light delay won't make it a conversation." "How far?" Naomi asked. "About 50 minutes one way." Naomi pictured the Oberon system, its three gas giants, the greater and lesser belts.
The Bikaji Kama was still a fair distance from the ring. She had time.
Thank you, she said. Not a problem, Chava said. I'm sending you the route and encryption. I'll see you for dinner tonight?
I don't want to impose.
It isn't an imposition, Chava said.
And it's safer than any place else.
Then yes, thank you, Naomi said. Chava smiled and killed the connection. Naomi thumbed up the data packet configuration and slotted in the information she'd been given. If it worked, it would slide unnoticed through the Transport Union system and appear to Emma Zamorodi in particular. Naomi considered herself in the preview display. Dust and sweat-smeared skin, hair more pale than black, wrinkles at her eyes and mouth. This was the woman who turned down High Consul Winston Duarte's invitation to live the rest of her life in a palace with the man she loved in order to take on the one job she never wanted. She smiled, and the woman on the screen looked happy. Exhausted, yes. Well bruised by life, yes. But happy. She started the recording.
Emma, I need to ask you to break protocol for me. I want you to send me everything you know about the status and function of the underground. Contacts, ship names, procedures. Anything you have, tell me. And if you can get messages to your operatives, tell them to expect a message like this from me in the near future. I know it's exactly what I told you never to do before, but the situation has changed. Medina is off the board, and we've lost Saba. We have to regroup, reorganize, and someone has to take initiative. A thick trickle of sweat broke free from her temple and began its slow fall down toward her eyebrow. She wiped it away, pulling her hair back from her eyes. Until you hear otherwise from me, I will be running the underground.
Chapter 26. Elvie. Elvie woke herself, trying to scream. She didn't remember the dream, just the sense of overwhelming fear and paralysis. The effort to make herself heard that seemed to go on for hours, even though all it managed was a little groan loud enough to bring her back to consciousness. It left her in the darkness, drenched in sweat and grateful for another few sleepless hours. The suite was courtesy of the Laconian state, two beds, both with autodocks built into them, one for her, the other for Faez, who, fortunately, was still breathing deeply and heavily. She knew without looking that she hadn't woken him up. She was grateful for that, too. She didn't turn the light on. Her cane was at her bedside, and she found it easily enough. She levered herself to the edge of the mattress, steeled herself, and swung her legs over. It hurt like hell, but only for a few seconds. Standing up was actually better, and she was leaning on the cane less than she had been. The night terrors were looking pretty robust, though. Trying hard not to make enough noise to wake her husband, she went through the darkness to the closet. The servants had left robes for them both, thick, textured cotton with a lining of something that might have been silk. She pulled it on one sleeve at a time, cinched it closed, and made her way out to the courtyard and a stone bench carved with complex mathematical patterns like something out of a mosque. Her memory of the rescue was spotty at best. She remembered giving the emergency evacuation order to the Falcon. She remembered coming back to consciousness in normal space and calling for help, crawling through blood and crash couch gel to Faez. That part was pretty clear. After that, a few lucid moments of trying to cinch a belt around Faez's calf as a tourniquet. At some point, she'd decided that she was losing too much blood, slipped her hand into the hole in her leg and made a fist in there to apply pressure all around. That probably should have been the worst part. Her wrist vanishing into the skin of her own leg like a graphics processing failure. What she actually felt at the time was a pride at having come up with a graceful solution. The tourniquet had been hard. They told her she had been conscious when the rescue ship came, but she didn't remember it. She knew, because she'd read the reports, that Jen had lived and was being treated somewhere else in the city. That Admiral Segale had died, half his head ripped away. That Trevon was technically listed as missing, since it was possible he could have survived someplace without the arm he left behind. The casualties among the rest of the crew were similar. About half had survived. No one had come through uninjured. The Falcon had been stabilized, too, and brought home to be healed and studied. Some local animal was making its call, four distinct notes repeated again and again at different speeds. Mating call, warning, alerting the hive to a food source. She had no way to know, but it was pretty. The night air was cool, almost to the point of discomfort, but she didn't want to go back inside for a coat. She'd just wait until she got tired and head back to bed, or else find some other lobby in the palatial buildings to sit in until dawn broke. If anyone wondered why there was a lady with a bathrobe and a cane wandering around, she'd just tell them it was classified. Exobiology wasn't medicine. She knew more about predictive parallel evolution models than she did about wound care. If she hadn't had a rank in the science directorate, she wouldn't have been able to see her medical records, and mostly for good reasons. It was dangerous for someone with one expertise to try to interpret something in a different but similar field. Laypeople didn't understand how much scientific literature was about nuance and shared understanding. Even with expert systems to help, she was more likely to avoid errors with one of Jen Lively's physics analyses than her own medical records, if only because she knew that she didn't know physics. But she'd looked anyway. The medical team had fought hard to keep her and Fires alive. The cuts where their flesh had gone missing were strange. Something about the wounds had made clotting weird, too, which of course immediately left her thinking of vampire bats and leeches, organisms that fed on blood and produced anticoagulants, which there was no reason to think these attackers had. The incisions in the decking had the same too-perfect margins. A more comprehensive report was still in draft form, but she was able to access that, too. Segale appeared to have died instantly. Others in the crew had lived long enough for the wounded Falcon to haul them through the gate and out of danger, only to bleed out or succumb to shock. The missing matter was just that. Missing. The scoop of her leg, Fias's foot, most of one lobe of Segale's brain, all of Trevon but his arm. It wasn't that they had been torn away. They'd been excised and taken elsewhere. All told, the Falcon had lost 12% of its mass, apparently at random. The dark things that moved between the spaces hadn't been targeting the crew. They'd meant to take everything. The human parts they'd removed were just points along a path. It almost made them worse. At least murderers had motives. She pulled aside the robe and looked at the wound. The medical gel that filled in the missing flesh was pale, but getting pinker. She could already trace the lines where blood vessels were starting to form. Muscle and skin would follow over the next few weeks and months. In the end, she'd probably have a slightly discolored patch on her leg where the skin was younger than she was. Segale, on the other hand, she shuddered. It was still hard to accept that he was gone. She didn't notice the dawn starting. The courtyard didn't open to the east, so it was just a slow, subtle graying of the Laconian sky. The retreat of the stars and the glowing construction platforms. Even then, what she noticed was the local organisms getting louder, and the gentle, vinegary smell that one of the local bird analogues made when it was waking up during mating season. She was cold and stiff and uncomfortable, but she didn't move until Kelly, Duarte's personal attendant, appeared.
"Major Okoye," Kelly said. "You're up early?"
"Or late," Elvis said, trying on a smile. It didn't really fit.
"Admiral Trejo arrived from Sol System last night."
"That was fast."
"I understand the burn was punishing.
Still, he asked if you could join us after breakfast."
"I can,"
Elvis said. "But the one I need to talk to is the High Consul." Kelly's smile revealed nothing.
"That's worth discussing with the Admiral."
Elvi had only ever seen Anton Trejo on screens. In person, he was a little underwhelming at first, and then, after a few minutes, she understood how he'd become the most decorated man in the Laconian military. He was stocky. His hair was dark and thin enough she could see pretty much all of his scalp through it. His eyes were a vivid green. A few years back, he'd conquered all of human civilization in less than a month. His manner was gentle. Like everyone but him was a little fragile, and he didn't want to break them unintentionally. He didn't come across as having much to prove. The meeting room was casual, tapestry-upholstered couches and a low, long table of polished stone. The others were all men. Colonel Illich, who Elvi had met a few times when she'd first been pressed into the Laconian military, Kelly, who had brought her, and her immediate superior, Paolo Cortázar, who headed the science directorate and coordinated pretty much all the research Laconia did. Winston Duarte wasn't there.
"Thank you for joining us, Doctor," Trejo said as she took a seat across from him. "I read the reports on the incident in the ring space. That's some hairy shit there."
She took the casual profanity as a sign of his respect. He was treating her as a peer.
"It was," she said. "I'm hoping not to do that again."
"We'll try to keep it that way. I was a little anxious making the transit myself. I mean, I wasn't awake for it. I heard you were awake in one of these new full immersion couches. I don't think I'd enjoy that. I don't like going over 20G asleep, much less watching it happen."
"I'm glad you made it," Elvi said. Cortázar shrugged and looked at his fingernails. Performative boredom.
He wasn't happy she was there. With a little taste of spite, she found a way to draw the pleasantries out a little more. "I hope there wasn't any trouble for you."
"No, no," Trejo said. "I was fine. There are problems, though. People are starting to make their own transits. One poor bastard out of Bellerophon tried to speed through, transit into ring space and transit back out in the same burn. He hadn't heard about how the gates all shifted position a little. His ship hit the edge of the gate hub about 300 clicks to the left of the gate he was aiming for."
"Ouch," Elvi said.
"People are getting desperate. For every system that can sustain itself, there's dozens that aren't there yet. Trade isn't optional for them. It's life and death. And without a traffic authority, death comes a lot more often."
"I'm sorry about Medina and the typhoon," Elvi said.
"Admiral Song was a good sailor," Trejo said.
"Died with her boots on. That's as much as any of us can ask. But there'll be time enough to toast the dead later. I have a problem, Doctor, and I have chosen to make part of my problem your problem, too."
Cortázar sighed and looked away. Trejo explained what had happened to the High Consul, then asked Kelly to bring them some tea while Elvi got over the shock. It was green tea, poured from a cast-iron kettle into black ceramic mugs. She'd had two servings before she felt like she'd found her feet again.
"So, there's no one running the Empire?" she said.
"We are running the Empire on the High Consul's behalf until such time as he is sufficiently recovered to take over the duties himself," Trejo said.
then paused and added, "Or his daughter has reached an age sufficient to take over in his place."
"She's very bright," Colonel Illich said, "and she's controllable. The High Council believed, and I agree, that the narrative of succession had to be familiar and reassuring. Primogeniture is a common model across a wide band of cultures and backgrounds. Of course, she won't be expected to actually wield power until she has shown an aptitude and willingness."
"How old is she?" Elvi asked.
"Duarte hoped he'd have a couple centuries to train her up," Trejo said. "Hell, he hoped he could stay on the bench forever. But these are the cards we have, and so we're going to play them. I'm not going to sugarcoat this. We've got a lot to carry, and most of that is going to fall on the science directorate."
"How can I help?" Elvi asked. It sounded better than, "What the fuck do you want me to do about this?"
"Your top mission is to get the High Council back," Trejo said. "Dr. Cortázar will walk you through everything he's done so far. We're hoping a pair of fresh eyes will find something he hasn't."
Elvi looked over at Cortázar. He wasn't looking at her. So this was why he was pouting. Trejo had called his competence into question. That was going to be unpleasant.
"While you do that, I'm going to be getting things back under control," Trejo said. "The voice of the whirlwind still a few weeks shy of her shakedown, but we're not stationing any crewed vessel in the ring space, and we're keeping the transit short. Whirlwind's going to be protecting Laconia. Tempest is staying in Sol. There's a situation there that needs an eye on it, and Sol's the most unruly system we have to worry about."
"And the traffic control?" Elvi asked.
"We can't hold the inside of gates," Trejo said. "So we're going to have to take the outsides. We have 280 Pulsar-class destroyers to police 1,371 gates."
For a moment, Elvi saw the enormity of what Trejo was facing pressed down on him. The bright green eyes focused on nothing, and the cheerful, confident face only looked tired. But a moment later, he was back.
"I'll be deploying those to systems most likely to have high traffic. We'll get the comms network back. And after the whirlwind's ready, we're turning all the construction platforms over to generating more antimatter charges. That brings us to your number two priority. I think we can all agree this tit-for-tat, see if we can be reasonable plan hasn't gone so well. We're going to gear up to fight this war for real. Anything you can find that will give us an..."
Adrenaline flooded Elvi's bloodstream. Her heart hit her ribs like a hammer.
"Are you fucking crazy?"
Illich and Kelly shared a look as if she'd confirmed something. Cortázar sneered.
"I'm sorry," Elvi said. "Wait, no, I'm actually not. Are you fucking crazy? Did you not see what just happened?"
Trejo bowed his head. His scalp glimmered at her through his sparse hair.
"I understand that this is a hard conversation for you right now, Doctor. You've been through a lot. But I'm a military man, and the fact is that we are at war. We have been at war since the first time a ship failed a transit.
Those things killed..."
"I know what they did."
Trejo's voice was harsh. It pushed her back into her seat.
"And I know why they did it. Because they got hurt. That means they can be hurt. And unless they find some way to sue for peace, I intend to prepare our forces to hurt them again. Candidly, I don't like it. We're going up against something we don't understand, with unfamiliar tools on a battlefield whose constraints we're working out as we go along. It's a stupid war, but it's ours. If it can be won, I intend to win it. You're going to help me."
100 objections rose in her mind, but fell back at the sight of the bright green eyes.
"Yes, sir," she said.
"Good. Please begin your review with Dr. Cortázar and keep me apprised of any insights or progress."
"I will," Elvi said at the same moment that Cortázar said, "We will."
Trejo accepted the answers as if they'd been the same. When he spoke to Elvie. If you disapprove of my plan of action, it's easy to stop me. Just get me my boss back. I'm going to try, Elvie said. Elvie walked back to her rooms before she left the state building for the science directorate. She wanted to clear her head, but it wasn't clearing. Every thought she had seemed to fight its way to consciousness like it was swimming through gel. Her leg ached worse now, and the sleepless hours were starting to weigh on her, pulling her toward bed now that she had obligations. Or maybe she was just realizing that her time of healing after the trauma was over, and she wasn't remotely okay. The grounds were beautiful, better than the best luxury resort. The weird, leathery flyers they called sunbirds were out, flapping high above the buildings, and looking more like bats than birds. Something like a dragonfly zoomed past her, wings buzzing here, both the same as and entirely differently than they would have on Earth. The scale of it all was too big. There were too many billion people in too many hundred solar systems for anyone to really understand, for any human to really understand. Maybe that was why Winston Duarte had decided not to be human anymore. Him or his daughter, either. It made her wish she'd majored in mathematics instead. They hadn't sent any mathematicians to Illis. And without Illis, she wouldn't have been the nearest thing to an expert on the wounds in reality that those dark things left. And she wouldn't have been recruited by Laconia. And she wouldn't be here. One little change early on could have meant a whole different life. She turned the last corner before her courtyard, and there, out in the gardens, Fias sat. One leg ended in a bright blue pod the size of a boot, where his missing foot was already starting to grow back. The other was stretched out on a bench, and leaning against the back of the bench, James Holden. As if he had felt the pressure of her gaze, Holden looked up and waved. He seemed both older and as though he hadn't changed at all. She started toward the bench, leaning more on her cane than she'd had to before. The gel in her leg felt like it was burning. Hours more standing and walking through Cortázar's lab sounded awful. As she approached, Holden and Fayez exchanged a few words, and Holden walked off briskly. By the time she got to her husband's side, Holden had disappeared behind a hedge. Fayez moved his good leg and gave her room to sit. There were dark pouches under his eyes, but his smile was as amused and sardonic as the day she'd met him. Or the day she'd married him. Or that one time when they'd almost died because a terrorist had booby-trapped a landing pad. "I think I must have lived my life wrong somehow," she said. "I know the feeling," he said. "But then I see you, and I think something must have gone right. Even if everything else treats me like my previous incarnation killed a priest." She took his hand, wove her fingers with his. The future looked a little less bleak. "I just had the most interesting conversation," Fayez said. "I could say the same," she said. "But mine's classified, so why don't you go first?" "Well, he was being awfully cagey, but I think our old friend Holden just told me Cortázar's plotting murder." Chapter 27. Teresa. Nothing was the same anymore. She tried to pretend that it was, that her father was only sick, the way normal fathers were sometimes. She woke up in the morning and Muskrat was there. She walked through the gardens and the state building the way she always had. Everyone she saw treated her just the same, except Illich, who knew the truth. She assumed that everyone thought her father was in deep consultations with the best minds of the Empire because of what happened to the Typhoon. They had faith in him. He was Laconia. She thought the guards stood a little taller when she walked by, that the cooks at the commissary saved the best dishes for her. It wasn't because she deserved them. It was because she was the closest thing they could get to him, and they wanted to make their offerings. They were scared by what they'd seen. She was, too. But they had a story where everything would be all right, and she didn't. The closest thing she had was Illich, and he was gone now more than he was with her. When he did see her, the only lessons they did were the new rules. Don't tell anyone about the High Council. Don't act frightened. Don't leave the grounds of the state building. She tried watching her favorite films and news feeds, but they didn't hold her attention. She tried reading her favorite books, but the words all slid off her mind. She tried running the length of the security wall as fast as she could for as long as she could, until the pain and exhaustion made it impossible to think or feel anything. It was as close as she came to peace. And in the afternoons and early evenings, she went and sat with her father. He suffered Kelly to bathe and dress him, so whenever she came he looked trim and neat. She sat beside him at his desk and used his displays to go over simple mathematical proofs or the diagrams of ancient battles. Sometimes he would nod at the images, as if deep in thought. Sometimes he would pat at the air around her head, like he saw something there. She found herself really looking at him, staring. His cheeks were rough from old acne scars. His hair was a little thin at the temples. The skin at his jaw was soft with age. And there were other things. The opalescence that sometimes made his skin shine like mother of pearl and other times nearly vanished. The darkness in his eyes, like storm clouds. The more she looked, the less he seemed like her father, the great man who strode the universe and her personal life with the confidence of a god, and the more he seemed like just someone. The worst times were when he looked sad or frightened. He didn't particularly notice when she cried. Illich did what he could. I'm sorry I haven't been as available since, well, since. They were sitting at the fountain where he'd taught her about displacement. How to make something heavier than water float by making it hollow. She looked at the rippling surface of the water and wondered whether she'd float now, too. It's all right, she said. I understand. His skin looked ashy. His eyes were watery with exhaustion and stress. His smile was the same as it had ever been. She'd thought before it was because he wasn't afraid of her. Now it just seemed well-practiced. This may not help, he said. But part of what you're feeling right now is normal. There's a moment that everyone eventually experiences when they see that their parents are just people, that these mythic figures in their lives are also struggling and guessing, doing their best without knowing for certain what their best is. The anger in Teresa's chest was the first warm thing she'd felt in days. My father is the ruler of the human race, she said. Illich chuckled. Had he always chuckled exactly that same way, and she was only noticing it now? That does change some aspects of it, yes, but I don't want you to feel alone. Have you considered not making me alone? She didn't say. Or is it just a feeling that matters? I know it's hard having this secret, he said. The only reason we're doing this is that your father and you are so important. I understand, she said, and pictured what he would look like if she drowned him in the fountain. I'll be okay. She didn't sleep that night. The anger that had surprised her so much in Elsa Singh had infected her. As soon as she put her head on her pillow and closed her eyes, she was in a shouting match with Illich, or with Cordelia.